Okay, so often in this class, when we get to a certain topic, so some of the topics I'm more familiar with, I've researched before, I have some ideas to share already in my head about the topic. Sometimes I challenge myself, and I approach a topic in the Torah which I have not looked into, it's a little more obscure. But one of my favorite things is trying to find the lessons and messages in even the most obscure topics we find in the Torah, because every single part of the Torah is meaningful. It says in the Torah, Lo davar ricku mikem, there is nothing empty in the Torah. And the rabbis say, if it's empty, mikem hu rik, it's empty because of you, not because of the Torah itself, because we don't get it. But if we learn how to get it, we learn how to understand the message, then no part of the Torah is empty. So as we're growing through mitzvos, we have skipped some. This mitzvah we're going to discuss today is actually number 208 in the count. We do not have 208 classes on mitzvos. We covered a bunch of them. We have been skipping around some. But mitzvah number 208 in the mitzvah count, according to the Sefer HaChinuch, is a very interesting prohibition, which at first does not sound relevant to us, but we'll see how it is relevant. And this prohibition, for those who saw on the email, which did get around or didn't get around, is called giving our children to, not to give our children to Molech. Molech. In Hebrew, Mem Lamed Chaf. In English, M-O-L-E-C-H. Molech. Molech is mentioned twice in the book of Vayikra, Leviticus. The first time in chapter 18. And it's tucked in, interestingly, in the whole discussion of immorality, of all the incestual relationships which are prohibited. So in that discussion, it tucks in this mitzvah. And the mitzvah is the prohibition. Do not give your children to pass to Molech. Do not defame or disgrace the name of your God, I am Hashem. So, or desecrate the name of your God, I am Hashem. So it tells you, you cannot give over your kids to pass to Molech, to the Molech. It's mentioned again in chapter 20 of Leviticus. And this time you'll hear the Torah is uncharacteristically harsh with the ones who perform this terrible act. The Torah says that God spoke to Moshe, speak to the children of Israel, and say, every individual from amongst the children of Israel, and from the Gera Garbi Yisrael, and from the converts, that give from their children to Molech, shall die, they shall be stoned by the people. God says, and I am going to focus my attention on that person. I'll cut him off from the midst of his nation. Because he gave his children over to Molech. And he defiled my sanctuary. And he desecrated my name. And then he continues. And if people hide their eyes from this person, when he gave over his children to Molech, and don't kill him, God says again, I'm going to focus my attention on this person, on his family. I'll cut him off, and all those that follow after him, to stray after Molech from amongst the nation, etc. So it's an extremely harsh warning for prohibition. I mean, you don't even find such harsh language when it comes to murder idolatry. But yet, when it comes to this idea of Molech, which we'll discuss what it is, I'm leaving it vague at this point, when it comes to this idea of giving children to Molech, the Torah really comes out harsh against those who are involved. I'll focus my attention on him, and I'll cut off him and his family. You can't hide your eyes from this person. It seems like a very heinous crime, giving over children to Molech. So we have to understand, what is this prohibition? What is Molech? What's the prohibition? Why is it so severe and so harsh? And what are the lessons that we can draw from this prohibition? So let's start off just describing what Molech is and isn't. There's a dispute in the Talmud about what Molech is. Some opinions say that Molech was an idol. There's an idol named Molech, and there's a certain service done before this idol. Others say that Molech is not an idol, it's not a form of idolatry, but it was kind of like a good luck ceremony. It's like a ritual. It's not really an idolatrous worship, but there was a ritual done by the pagans in order to kind of incur good luck, that fate should treat them properly. That's the other opinion. So the two opinions are maybe a specific form of worship of an idol, named Molech, or it might be just some form of ritual. It's not a worship service, but yet it's supposed to bring on good luck to a person or to a person's family. That's number one. So that's a dispute if it's actually idolatry or not. It's definitely a pagan practice, but is it a service of an idol or just a good luck ceremony? That can be determined. There's two parts to giving over a child to Molech. The Talmud tells us that for a person to be liable to the death penalty in giving over a child to Molech, there's two things that have to be done. Number one is you give the child to the priests of the Molech, and then they pass the child through a fire. We'll discuss what kind of what we're talking about, passing through a fire. Those are the two steps. You give the child to the priest of the Molech, and then the child is passed through a fire. If these two steps aren't done, the person is not liable for what he did. He's only liable in a Jewish court if he did both steps. There's a kind of a surprising or strange halacha, which we'll discuss as well, that a person is only liable for this Molech ceremony if they give over some of their children to Molech. If a person were to give all their offspring to Molech, they're exempt in the court. So if a person has three kids and gives two of his kids or one of his kids to Molech, he'll be executed by a Jewish court. If he gives all three to the Molech, then the court won't touch it. It's a very strange, you know, surprising halacha. There's a dispute over what exactly was done in the Molech ceremony. So we know that there was giving over to the priest, and we know that there was fire involved. But the Talmud has a dispute over what they actually did. So the great sage Abaye, he said that essentially you would have a brick pathway, like a brick bridge. On either side of the bridge would be fire. And the child was supposed to walk over this brick bridge in between the flames. That's what would happen. The sage Rava says that's not how it worked. He says there was a pit of fire, and the child would jump over the fire. So either you're jumping over fire, or you're walking in between fire. So you can see even in the Talmud, it was unclear what this practice was exactly. In the Talmud, when it was written, this is already, I guess, when this practice was already old news. So based on our tradition, we're not sure exactly how the practice was done. It was either walking over a bridge in between fire, or jumping over a fire in a pit. It's also a dispute who would cross the child over the fire. Would it be the father, or would it be the priest? That's also a dispute. Another dispute is, did they actually kill the child in the ceremony, or did the child come out alive? Meaning that the Rashi and Rambam, Maimonides, they are of the opinion that the child wasn't necessarily killed in the ceremony. It wasn't human sacrifice. It was a ceremony. It was a ritual. But it wasn't human sacrifice. Ramban, Nachmanides, he says that the child actually killed in the ceremony. It was a form of human sacrifice. That's what was done. So that's also left open as a dispute. So, just to put it all together, we have a lot of questions. But let's just try to sum up what Molech was. So Molech was either an idolatrous worship or it was just a ritual for good luck. That's point number one. Point number two is that there's two points. Either you give the child to the priest and then the child passes it through fire. It may have been walking on a bridge in between fire or maybe jumping over a fire pit. It may be the father or the priest that crossed the child over. And it's a dispute if the child was actually killed in the ceremony or if the child came out alive at the end. Those are all the different discussions and disputes amongst what this practice actually what actually happened here. So that's a practice. It's old news. I don't believe it's done in the world anymore. Not relevant to us in a practical sense. But let's understand the lessons of it, because if the Torah gives a prohibition, the Torah is timeless. The Torah's lessons are timeless, and there must be lessons within the practice of Molech that we can learn. Additionally, the fact that Torah gives such a harsh warning about it, as we read before. The God says, I'm going to focus my attention on this person. I'm going to cut him off and his family off and all these terrible warnings given to the person who may be tempted to give their child to Molech. Let's understand what's so severe, what's so serious about this crime. So first and foremost, just on a simple level, assuming that the child is killed, the Torah reviles human sacrifice. Pagans at those times used to have human sacrifice. And the Torah does not allow human sacrifice. The Torah values human life, and God is not interested in people being sacrificed to Him. God wants people to live. I don't want people to die, God says. I want you to live. I want you to prosper. So to kill a child with such cruelty as a service and a worship, that's certainly a terrible thing. It's an idolatry in addition to murder as well to a child in such a cruel way. Certainly it's a terrible crime. That's number one. So there's such an act of cruelty involved, like giving a child over in this way, that's what the Torah cannot forgive. And assuming that's the understanding, we can learn a great lesson from the point that you're only liable if you give over some of your children, not all of your children. What's this point? And this is a point which sometimes we struggle with. We have to understand, in God's world, we believe there's divine punishment and human punishment. And human punishment is sometimes considered positive. It's usually considered positive because human punishment provides atonement for a person. So we said the rule is if you give all your children to Molech, the court will not punish you. If you give some of your children to Molech, the court will punish you. Why is that? So one of the earliest compilations of mitzvos and halacha called the Smag, the Sefer Mitzvos Gedolos. He writes that if you give all your children to the Molech, the crime is so disgusting, it's so heinous, you've crossed the line, you've really crossed the line, then God doesn't want to offer you any form of atonement. Being punished in a human court means that even if a person is executed, that person, when they go up to heaven, will be atoned for that sin. The rabbis teach us that when a person went through a human punishment in this world, through the Jewish court system, that would give them a forgiveness up in heaven. That's what it was for. But God says, according to this opinion, that if you give all your children to Molech, your crime is so disgusting, you've gone so far, you've done something which is so terrible, I don't want to give you the privilege of being punished. You're not going to get that privilege. You'll have to deal with me. After you die, after 120 years, you'll come up to heaven and you'll deal with me. That's what God says. So on the one hand, you have a lesson from this, that there's a perspective given to us to understand punishment. Both heavenly punishment and earthly punishment, the point of punishment from God is not to be punitive. It's all in order for the person's benefit. It's all to help us grow, help us become better, give us forgiveness, give us atonement. There are times where the human court will not punish, not because you don't deserve punishment, but because the punishment that they have to give you is too light for you, and we want God to deal with you. Because you don't deserve this atonement, God should give you a different punishment. You need more atonement. You need to deal with God directly. There's an interesting halacha, which is that if somebody murders unintentionally, manslaughter. So in the times when the Jews were in control of the land of Israel, and we had a Sanhedrin, and we had the Jewish king, so a murderer, someone who was involved in manslaughter, who murdered unintentionally, would be sent to a city of refuge, an Eir Miklat. He's sent to exile. He had to leave his hometown and go to a specific city designated for these people who murdered unintentionally. But if somebody did something that was totally negligent, so then they didn't have to do anything. They went to the court, and the court proved that what they did was like gross negligence. And really what they did was just a total stupid act, and that's why they killed somebody else. So they're off the hook. Now it's kind of strange. If I wasn't negligent, if it was just kind of like an innocent mistake, but it wasn't gross negligence, so then they're going to make me leave my town and send me off to exile. If I did something that was just totally grossly negligent, it was totally stupid, I wasn't paying attention, I did something dangerous, and I killed somebody with it, the court says, okay, have a nice day, go home. So it's counterintuitive. But the answer is that we have to understand being punished by the court was a privilege. Because if you get punished by the court, that means that God will forgive you, and you're not subject to divine punishment after that. But the court says, well, your act was a little bit too extreme. We can't punish you for it because we want God to deal with you. So if you're looking from the human perspective, you don't bring the divine into the picture, it sounds strange because we're letting this criminal off the hook. This guy was negligent and we're letting him walk. But if you take it from the larger perspective, the Torah's perspective, that we're looking at divine punishment as well as human punishment, so let me say this person is left up to God. The court only has power to a certain degree, and it's a privilege to be punished by the court because that will help you have forgiveness in God's eyes. If the court deems that you did something that was too severe for us to punish, so then will God punish you. That's how we understand it. So here as well, the way that this commentary, the Smag, understands this idea of Molech, he says that if you give all your kids to Molech, what you did was so severe, the court's not going to touch you, will God deal with you. But we're not going to give you the privilege of being punished by the human court. So we have to understand that being punished is a privilege. And we understand that at times. You know, we understand that a teacher disciplining a student, a parent disciplining a child, is for the child's benefit, for the student's benefit. So when we get punished, it's also for our benefit. So the court can't decide that we're going to let you off the hook for such a severe crime. Torah says that crime leads up to God to deal with because we don't want to give you the privilege. We don't give you that honor of having human punishment and being then forgiven by God in heaven. So that's one point. Now there's another important point you learn from this whole episode of Molech, which is the following. We discussed how Molech was kind of a good luck ritual. And even if it was an idolatrous practice, still the priest would guarantee, the priest would come to you and say, if you do this, you'll have good luck. Your family will have good luck, you'll prosper, you'll succeed. And it's a dispute how exactly it worked. But some say that if you give over one child to Molech, you'll see that the rest of your kids will succeed. They'll prosper in life, you'll prosper in life, your household will prosper. That's what you'll see. So the priests of the Molech would convince the person to give over some of their children so others would succeed. But if you're going to take all their children away, so then you can't guarantee the children will succeed because they're all gone. So the practice wasn't to ask for all the children, but to ask for some of the children. Because there's none left to receive this blessing that you'd get, this good luck blessing you would get if you gave over all your children to Molech. Also, if you gave all your children to Molech, it'd be hard to convince a parent to part all their children. To convince them to part with one, this will give you a blessing in your house, okay, but to convince them to part with all, that'd be a very difficult step for somebody to take, and probably the priest would not be too successful in their mission. Be it as it may, either way you look at it, the priest would offer you good luck. They'll say, don't worry, if you do this, you're going to succeed in everything you do, your kids will succeed. And the Rambam even says that they would also say the opposite. If you don't give over your kids to Moloch, your kids will die. So, you know, give over this one kid, and others will live. Or assuming the kid would live, give over to him, or he's going to die. If you don't give me that kid, and let him cross over to Moloch, he's going to die for some other reason. Assuming that they didn't kill him, and it says he was human sacrifice. But this is a classic tactic of the pagans. And I understand this point as well. And they'll say, if you want to have good luck, you want to prosper, give me something, and we'll give you something back. And I've heard it termed before as kind of a vending machine. It's kind of like a vending machine. You know, Jews don't believe in this, but pagans, the way it would work is that, you know, I dance for the rain god, and the rain god gives me rain. You know, I offer the sacrifice to the wheat god, and the wheat god gives me wheat. I offer a sacrifice to the sun god, and there's sunshine. You know, that's how it works. It's kind of like playing in the vending machine. You put in your quarter, you put in your 50 cents, you put in your dollar, and you get out what you want. That's what it is. It's the vending machine religion. You put in X, you get out Y. The Torah doesn't believe in that. The Torah says, of course we believe in divine reward and punishment. Of course God rewards us. But we don't look at our relationship with God as a vending machine. We understand that it's a relationship. We serve God because it's the truth, because God wants us to make a relationship with Him. God wants us to become the best people we can be. We try to create a real loving relationship, a real intimate relationship with God. There's a love involved. We mitzvah to love God. God loves us. It's like a marriage. Now imagine in a marriage, so one spouse says, okay, if I wash 5 dishes, then you'll cook me dinner tonight. And they have like a business deal going on. So that'd be a failure of a marriage. A marriage is a relationship. So there's a partnership involved. It's not that, okay, I do X, you do Y. That's how we view God. The Torah often compares the relationship of God and the Jewish people to a marriage. God's like the husband, we're like the wife, and that's the relationship. So in a marriage relationship, it's not going to be a vending machine. If it is, it's not going to last very long. But in a marriage relationship, we care for each other, we're partners with each other, we try to work with each other, for each other, do for each other. There's a mutual loving care, and that's the relationship. So the idolaters would say, no, it's like a vending machine. That's how they would view it. You want to have something in life, you have to give something to the gods, and they'll give something back. But there was no personal attention. There's no intimate relationship. There's no love. There's no care from the god to the person. It was just a very dry system. That's how they viewed it. So you give the god a child, he'll let you succeed. You don't give him a child, they won't succeed. That's it. Finished. And that's how it works. That was the system. What?
Very strange.
Very strange, right? I mean, that was the world for a few thousand years, you know? It really was.
What time period was this?
I mean, we're dealing here with essentially the period of the Torah and the First Temple period, which was, I don't know, from really the times of Abraham, which would be 1940 on the Jewish calendar, going all the way through the end of the First Temple period, being a Second Temple period, which we'll say is around the year, I don't know, 500 BCE, something like that. But it's in the Jewish calendar, I guess, around like, I don't know, 4,000? I don't know, less than that, 3,500? I don't know. I'm not good with dates, but like 4,000 in the Jewish calendar. I mean, but the world itself is an idolatrous world. I mean, historically, but the Torah sources, non-Torah sources. Until you get to the times of, you know, when Christianity started appearing on the scene, and they kind of took over the world at that point. Until that point, the world was idolatrous. The Romans, the Greeks, the Persians, everyone was idolatrous at that point. And pagan religions, that's how they function. Because when there's 10,000 gods, 1,000 gods, there's 5,000 gods, so each one you try to get something else out of. That's how it would work. If you're the god over the rain, I work with you to get my rain. And that was the relationship. There wasn't any sort of care or love in between them. So the Torah says that's not how God relates to the world. That's not what we believe in. And the Torah despises that. And the Torah says, you don't serve God in order to get good luck. That's not how it works. It's not that you serve God and the good things happen to you. You serve God, first and foremost, because it's the truth, the Torah tells you. Because there's one God, and He created everything. That's why you serve God. And in the service of God, it's supposed to become a relationship, like a marriage, like a loving relationship, a caring relationship, a partnership together. That's one point. But furthermore, when they would serve Molech in order to get good luck, so we have another good lesson. You know, we think that that's so far beyond us, that, you know, we're going to go and give a kid to some sort of idol to get good luck. But I mentioned in an email superstition. And superstition is something which is very abundant in the world, American society. It creeps into Jewish belief as well, unfortunately. And anytime, when general society tells you, I mean, in silly examples, you know, when you talk about walking under a ladder or a black cat or these things, even those things aside, but what's it doing? And the things that you hear in American culture, they're not as extreme as Moloch, obviously. But any practice people feel is lucky practices. They're good luck practices. You know, they'll people talk about knocking on wood and these types of things. So if they have no basis, they have no place in Judaism. You know, is there any basis that giving a kid over a fire is going to bring good luck to a person? Absolutely not. But that was the way they convinced people to do in the ancient world. So the Torah says that's a terrible crime, and that also involved possibly human sacrifice, etc. But in our level, there are things that we try to involve ourselves in which we think are good luck. And even if we don't do it purposely, there's subtle messages you get living in the society we live in. And these are good luck practices. But if you can't find a source in the Torah for these practices, then essentially it's superstition. We might call it chukos ha-goyim, doing rituals of the goyim, of the non-Jews, which are meaningless to us. And it's something which kind of relates back in a small way, but to the practice of Moloch. That's what it does, because it's doing things with no basis for good luck. To think that I can try to adjust my fate in some way based on some silly practice that I do. And even furthermore, I think that when it came to Moloch, they would sacrifice possibly a child for success. So we would never sacrifice a child for success. But what do we sacrifice for success? People in America will sacrifice very much to succeed monetarily. They'll sacrifice morals and values. They'll sacrifice family relationships. They'll sacrifice marriages. They'll sacrifice friends. I mean, you look around society, people who are trying to, quote-unquote, trying to achieve or succeed, which always in America means financially. So people do very often sacrifice a lot in their life for that. So they, in their days, would sacrifice a child physically. Their parents might sacrifice a child emotionally because they don't give their children the proper attention because they're so busy trying to succeed. People who sacrifice friendships. You have a friend, and because you're busy trying to succeed, you slight that friend, you don't talk to that friend, you don't keep up with the friend, and you know, things fall apart. We have morals, we have ethics, we have ideals, and you find people cutting corners to succeed. So what are you sacrificing there? You're sacrificing your dignity, you're sacrificing your ideals, you're sacrificing your relationship to God in order to succeed. So you have this idea of these good luck charms, but even furthermore, there's this idea of sacrificing for success, which people, you know, the child is someone's most precious possession, and in their days, they could be convinced to sacrifice a child for success. But we have to think in our lives, what do we sacrifice? You know, Moloch is the extreme. Moloch is the most extreme of sacrificing anything for success. But I think we're all guilty of it sometimes, that we do sacrifice things that are important to us for monetary gain, and for other gains we want in life, but it's a sacrifice. It's something that we shouldn't be doing. So that's another lesson that you take from Moloch. And again, Moloch is the extreme. Moloch is the far extreme. But the lessons of Moloch are abundant, and it's always there. The
no personification, no image.
What?
The idea of Moloch.
Yeah. Right. I mean, in their days, it's based on this dispute we talked about. If it was actually serving an idol, there was an idol named Moloch. But it's possible also that one opinion in the Talmud says, I mean, the word Moloch is the same letters as the word for a power, a king. Melech is a king. Melech olam. So Moloch could be anything that you place as your authority, that you're trying to serve in order to succeed. That's also Moloch. One opinion says you just take a stick in the ground, and then you do the whole fire practice. That's also a Moloch, because we can make our own Molochs, and we do make our own Molochs. We make those things that we think can give us luck, and we try to do what we can to get good luck. And if it's totally removed from God, then it has no place in Jewish thought. There's another point made about Moloch by Rav Hirsch, as we often quote. Rav Hirsch, who is taking the approach that Moloch is not idolatry, but is merely this good luck ritual, he says that Moloch is a concession that we make to luck or fate, meaning that it's really denying God's providence in our world. If we believe that the world is run by one God, who rules us with, he says, with quote, love and righteousness, then we realize that goodness comes not from destructive acts, but through living on a high moral ground, serving God, doing what's right, and when we're obedient to God's will, so then God provides for us. That's how Judaism views it. It's not luck. It's not that we're playing, you know, our cards right, and we're playing this game of chess and trying to beat fate. But like we said before, you're becoming partners with God, you're developing a relationship. And Rav Hirsch even says that Molech itself is not renouncing God as the creator, but Molech itself is trying to recognize the power of fate that goes beyond God. In Jewish thought, there's no fate. There's no luck. Nothing goes beyond God. Everything is in God's control. And the minute that we start thinking, well, you know, fate had it this way for me. You know, that's just how the cards fell. That's just, you know, how the cookie crumbled. Once we, you know, those types of things. So then at that point, we might still believe in a creator, and we're not renouncing God as our creator, but we're saying there's another power out there called fate, which controls my life other than God. And that's not true. Rav Hirsch says the practice of Molech is teaching us that you never, there's no such thing as making concessions to fate or to luck. There's no such thing as losing to luck, like we said before. If you're obedient to God, you live on high moral ground, stick to your ideals, then God takes care of you and leads you where you need to go. That's the Torah's view, period. Rav Hirsch even points out something very interesting. I mentioned back in Leviticus 18, chapter 18 of Vayikra. So this prohibition of giving over a child to Molech is tucked in a very interesting place. The Torah lists all the forbidden relationships, incestual relationships, not to reveal the nakedness of a parent or a sibling, etc., adultery, and all those types of things. And then tucked right into there, in between the prohibition of adultery and homosexuality and bestiality, you have this prohibition of Molech. Now, it seems very out of place, because, I mean, Molech is a severe crime. We look at immorality as a very severe crime. Incest is a very severe crime in the Torah. But it's just in the middle of this list, it doesn't seem to belong. So Rav Hirsch points out, why is Molech listed in the Torah in this very surprising location? Usually Torah, we look at the Torah as organized in a very specific way. When God writes the Torah, God puts everything where it's supposed to be. So if there's a list of relationships that are forbidden, incestual relationships, adulterous relationships, and tucked right in between is the prohibition of Molech, there must be some lesson there. So Rav Hirsch goes on to explain that what do forbidden relationships teach us? The fact that Torah prohibits incest or adultery, and the Torah says there should be marriage and promotes holiness in sexuality. So what is the Torah teaching us? The Torah is teaching us that children are not supposed to be the results of any haphazard blind relationship. When one has a child, it's supposed to be in a very specific relationship with a focus. It's like animals that just kind of breed. Animals just, you know, have lots of children with all sorts of mates. We're not mating. We're not breeding. But a child in Judaism is a result of a sacred, elevated family life that produces holy, pure souls in the child. When a Jewish child is born, you're bringing a new soul into the world. That's what you're doing. You're taking a soul from heaven and entering into our world. And we view a child as a piece of the divine. Every single Jew has within them their neshama and has within them a piece of God. That's what we have inside of us. So then to take a child, you give that child to Molech. You take this child, whether you kill the child or not, let's assume you kill the child, which makes it even more extreme. But you take a child and give the child to Molech, you're denying this child's holy connection to the Creator. That's what you're doing. You're saying that this child has no place in God's holy nation. This child is as if the child is part of the brood. You know, there was a breed, and we mated it, and we had lots of children. And you're able just to disregard one child for the rest of the brood. That's what it sounds like. It's the powers of fate. If the child's conceived in the framework of holiness, the sanctity like the Torah requires, so then that child will then succeed under Hashem's divine protection. But one should never think that a Jewish child could, whether it be the child who lived or died through the ritual, but you're denying this child's place in God's world. You're saying this child is no part of God with the child. This child needs to have concessions to fate. And if someone killed the child for the sake of the rest of the children, that's even worse. You're denying the child's divine spark within. You're denying that child's place in God's people. That's what you're doing. So it's such a terrible crime in that way, because, and then that's what Torah is delineating by putting it into the same list as all the forbidden relationships. Torah is saying the reason that God forbids certain relationships is because God wants children to be conceived in a very specific holy manner. And when you're bringing a holy soul into the world, it should be done in an elevated, sacred relationship. And therefore, God prohibits all sorts of relationships so that people zero in on the right ones. But, along the same token, if somebody takes that holy child, which was conceived in a holy way, and gives that child to Molech, sacrifices that child for the sake of others, again, you're denying that same principle. You're saying this child is not a child of God, has no sacred soul within, has no place in God's people. This child can be just disregarded and thrown off as a concession to fate. That's the way they're supposed to succeed. And that's a complete denial of the divine protection, divine spark in the child. The Ramban, Nachmanides, he seems to explain another point, a very related point, which is that when it comes to all other idolatrous practices, so you serve the idol, but you never give up the Jewish soul to the idol. When it comes to Molech, you take this precious child, the precious Jewish soul, the peace of God within, and you're giving it up to a pagan practice. The Torah says that when you give a child to Molech, you have desecrated God's name and you've defiled God's sanctuary. Because you've taken this child, which is a sanctuary of God, every single Jew is a sanctuary of God, we have it in us, the soul. And you've defiled it because you've given not just, you haven't just given a sacrifice of an animal to the idol, you haven't just served the idol, bowed down to the idol, burned incense to the idol. What have you done? You've taken a Jewish soul and you've offered that to the idol. And there's nothing worse than that. So that's what he says is part of the terrible crime of Molech. Furthermore, for a minute, Sarah, the HaMikdavar, which is a book written by the Netziv, Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda of Berlin, one of the great Jewish thinkers of, I guess, mid or late 19th century. So he writes that when one gives a child to Molech, so it's expressing a lack of faith in God more so than anything else in the whole Torah. Why? Because even if somebody worships an idol, so you could say, you know, we don't want to put all our eggs in one basket. You know, like, I have doubts in my faith in God, so I'll do a little of this, a little of that. Because, you know, maybe not, I'm not sure. So there's an element of doubt involved, which might drive a person to do other things which are not sanctioned by the Torah. But the person at least has a doubt in their mind, but they haven't totally rejected God. But just in order to diversify our portfolio, we would not kill a child. That's something that, so nobody would kill their child because they're not sure. That's for sure not. People would do a lot of things because they're not sure. But you're not totally, but when you kill a child, you're showing that I am totally convinced this is going to work. 100%. I'm 100% disregarding God, and I'm totally buying into this concept of Molech. Other things people might have done, they're idolatrous, so that doesn't express 100% conviction. Maybe they're convinced, 80%, 90%, possibly. Maybe 50-50. Maybe we don't know what the numbers were. But a person wants to, like we say, diversify their portfolio. You know, maybe I can just give one gift to this rain god over here. Maybe that'll good for me also. Maybe I'll bow down to this one, and that'll be good for me too. I don't know. But it's not something which is denying God totally. But giving a child over, killing a child, is a total denial of God's providence in this world. 100%. Because you're not going to do it unless you're 100% sure. So there's no greater rejection of God, than the Siv says, than giving a child to Molech. So after all that, we see that this crime, there's a lot more to it than just a good luck serum and idolatrous practice. There's a lack of faith in God. There's a cruelty. There's a denial of the Jewish soul and the holiness of a child. There is the willing to sacrifice values and things of importance to succeed in life. And these are all things that we could relate to. The Torah that continues about Molech, and it says, this is back in Vayikra chapter 20. So when God gives this warning about what will happen to the person who gives a child to Molech, so God says, I'm going to focus my attention on that person and on his family. And his family as well. So commentaries discuss, what does family do? We understand this person may have done something terrible, but why is God saying to punish the family? So one approach is that the family here does not mean his family per se, means those who support him. The Targum Unklis, which I think we discussed last week, who's the Aramaic translation of the Torah, he translates the word mishpacha here, not as family, but as sa'adohi, which means in Aramaic, his supporters. So according to that, we see a source in the Torah that even aiding somebody who's a criminal, like in America, you can't aid and abet a criminal. Same idea in Torah law. Those who aided the one who brought this child to Molech, even though you would never give a child to Molech, but if you help this person out, God says, I'm going to punish you too, because you can never aid a criminal. Everybody is guilty if this is a source of the Torah to show that you're guilty also when you aid a criminal in doing a terrible crime. But furthermore, Rashi explains, he uses an analogy, which is quoted from the rabbis, from sages in the Midrash. But the analogy is, that Rashi gives, is that if somebody is a tax collector, So tax collector in those days, it wasn't an IRS, which for the most part we view as honest and just, we hope. Tax collectors in those days were totally corrupt. Basically, the way it would work is that the king would say, you can buy the right to the tax collector, which means you pay me $1 million of taxes up front. Now you have the right to go around and tax everyone in the country. So, and then when you tax people in the country, you would make more than $1 million. That's basically how it works. So tax collectors were essentially thieves. That's what they were. They're bandits, they're thieves, they were corrupt. So Rashi says, there's nobody who's a tax collector whose family also are not tax collectors. Meaning that if somebody is a thief, then there's some influence of the family which is causing that. The family's involved, the family's part of it as well. That's essentially what it means. Now, what's the lesson for us? I mean, the people were saying if somebody in the family is a thief, then the rest of the family, at least in some way, will defend that person, support the person. But there's another deeper lesson here, which is that if somebody is willing to give a child over to Molech, they come from a certain family. So this is not an ironclad rule. But usually, there must have been some influence in this person's past which drove them in this direction. Maybe very subtle. So for instance, there's a story at the end of Tractate Sukkah in the Talmud. It tells a story of this woman named Miriam Bas Bilga. Miriam Bas Bilga was a descendant of a family of Kohanim. The Kohanim had different families. One family is called Bilga. And she came from the family of Bilga. Now she denounced her heritage. Renounced her heritage, and she married a Greek officer. And when the Greeks came into the temple, so the Talmud relates, this woman, who used to be Jewish, but now married this Greek, she came over to the altar, and she kicked it with her shoe. And she yelled at the altar. And she said, Lucas, Lucas, you know, you terrible wolf. You know, you eat all the money of the Jewish people, and you don't stand by them when they need you. The Jews kept giving sacrifices to the altar, and more sacrifices burning on the altar. And she said, you don't stand by the Jews, and they need you. So she kicked the altar and called it a wolf. Now, it happens to be the Torah compares the altar to the wolf as well, so it's not necessarily a negative thing. She called it a wolf in a negative way, and she says, you're a wolf, you eat up all of our money, and don't help us in a time of need. So the Mishnah relates, that not only was she punished for this, but her whole family is punished. The Bilga family of Kohanim, when they show up to work in the temple, so every family of Kohanim had a locker where they kept their stuff, where they kept like their knives, things they'd use for the sacrificial service. Theirs got locked up. They couldn't use their own knives anymore. So they were demoted to have to borrow knives every time. Every single family of Kohanim had a special hook on the ground where they tied down the animals to slaughter them. And their hook was locked. They weren't using their own hook anymore. They had to go and borrow someone else's hook, which also was demoralizing to them. The incoming families of Kohanim, when they would receive their portion of the sacrifices to eat, they would all stand in the north. The north was considered an honor. Why that is, it's a different discussion, but North was considered an honor. They're forced to always stand in the south, this family, because of this. So the whole family is punished for it. So the Gemara asks, well, why are you punishing the whole family? I mean, we understand, like, punishing this woman. Why are you punishing our family? Doesn't make sense to punish the entire family. So the Gemara has a quote. The Gemara says that when you hear a child speaking in the marketplace, you know it's coming from the father or the mother. They often, you know, when a kid will go out there and you'll hear him talking about, let's say, politics. Now, the kid doesn't know about politics. Where did he get it from? He got it from his parents, because his parents talk about politics. He talks about politics, too. But there's a deeper lesson there. You know, my wife, a long time ago, she taught in public school, and she had this child who was constantly saying all these terrible racist comments. And it's clear where it's coming from. She met the parents. She knew where it's coming from. But, you know, the child was like a second grader or something. But just, totally, like, racist comments all the time coming out of him. It was a special needs class, so, like, I guess he had trouble controlling himself, too. But it was very clear where those were coming from the parents. But the Gemara's lesson there is that when a child, so the family of Bilga would never dare marry a Greek, and would never dare kick the altar, would never scream at the altar in an insulting manner. But there must have been some subtle undertones within the family over the years, which the girl picked up, and she just took it to an extreme. So when it says about the those who serve Molech, that the family gets punished, there's a lesson involved. That there must have been some subtle message from the family as well that may have driven this person over the edge. So the family would never go to such extremes, but when they hear subtle messages from the parents or from siblings or from relatives, so then that could push you over the edge. Because if you grow up with these messages in your mind, that could really influence you. So it's not always true. Sometimes you have very good people and their kids have difficulties. But it's definitely, there's a truth to it. And we don't realize how often subtle messages are given that can turn, that could snowball into terrible evil. Whether it be family, whether it be with friends, you know, we often will express our beliefs, we'll often say things, we'll often say things under our breath, and we'll give a negative comment here and there. People are listening. And the more people hear negative comments, and people hear things which may be pessimistic or sarcastic, I mean, it builds up. And even though you would never act on it, do anything so extreme, but when people hear it, especially children, but even adults, when we hear these things, they build up in our minds. Eventually, it could push us to do something we haven't done before. So the family of the one who serves Molech gets punished because everybody in a family of thieves, we assume they're all thieves in some way. I mean, you would never steal, but you know, maybe make comments here and there. You might support the person who's stealing. You might make them feel okay about it. You might rationalize why it's okay and justify their actions. I mean, there's ways in which a subtle message gets across which causes somebody to steal. So that's the another lesson you get from the practice of Molech. And ultimately, as I mentioned before, the word molech itself comes from the root word mem, lam, and chaf, which is a melech, a king. Because molech doesn't have to be just this idol, whoever he looked like, named molech. But we, in our lives, we create these things of authority, which are imaginary, which are not real, which certainly aren't permanent like God is. And we do things in order to gain their favor, to serve them, to achieve success and good luck. We sacrifice for it, we sacrifice precious things for it, things that are important to us. We don't always realize what we're doing. But we all have our own molechs that we deal with. And just to recap it all, the crime of molech, in a way, I don't think any other crime in the Torah is given such a severe warning, such a harsh warning as molech is. This idea of God turning his attention on the person, the family, for desecrating the sanctuary, and desecrating God's name, and cutting him off, and stoning him, all these terrible things. Because molech is such an expression of a lack of faith in God and God's providence and God's existence and God's care and the holiness of a Jew and the holiness of a Jewish soul, all that together, we can never ever say attribute something to fate. There's no such thing as fate. Everything is God in our minds. No such thing as good luck. Good luck is not a Jewish idea. The idea is that there's a God in the world and God brings you where you need to be. And if you serve God and you're obedient, God takes you in the right direction. That's the idea. And if you make a relationship with God, God cares for you. This idea of a vending machine, we should never feel that we serve God to get good things. You know, and we feel that sometimes. You know, sometimes it's a motivation of us. And it's something which is not necessarily a negative thing on a temporary basis. And see, our relationship with God totally is that I want to have good in life and therefore I serve God. We're supposed to realize that it's a relationship, there's a love, there's a care. There's a partnership with God that we have in this world, and we're supposed to bring out God's sacred name into the world. We're supposed to serve God with love and feeling and emotion, and God then will take care of us with love and feeling and emotion. And that's how we view it. But to say I'm going to put in my dollar and get out my soda, that's something which is not a Jewish ideal and should never be done. And ultimately, we have this lesson that that everybody in the family is a tax collector. This idea that, you know, we have to realize the subtle messages that we give, the subtle ideas which come out of our mouths, which others do pick up on, and how we may not realize it, but we could cause terrible evil to happen by these very innocent comments. And that's the lesson of Molech. Any questions?
Yeah.
Yeah.